Welcome to the ESAS podcast. My name is Agnes Pelunite. Today we'll be continuing our discussion about vascular access. In the first part, we discussed preoperative planning, patient selection, and assessment. We're continuing with surgical techniques, complications, and follow-up. Let's get started. What is your preferred anesthetic technique, local, regional, or general, for vascular access surgery, and how do you decide which to use? By the way, the previous access guidelines mention an advantage of regional anesthesia in possibly improving access patency rates. Do you take this recommendation in consideration in your everyday practice?
Yes, we do. However, the decision around anesthetic and vascular access surgery still, I think, varies a lot according to country, local policies, hospital, personal experiences. And it depends on, of course, on the surgeons and the anesthetist available in the team. There has been some evidence that due to the vasodilatation of peripheral vessels and temporary increase of blood flow, regional block do have a positive impact on the fistula success. In the UK, we're currently waiting for results of a large multi-centered randomized control trial. It's called ACCESS. And they're basically comparing primary unassisted patency at 1 year of primary artery venous fistula created under regional anesthetic compared to local anesthetic. So we look forward to those results to come back because I think they are going to change the practice in many places. Personally, I consider regional anesthetic, especially when I have to do radiocephalic fistula and especially on small caliber vessels. Regional block is very useful when you have high BMI patients, for instance, or even anxious patients that might be reassured with having their arm blocked instead of only local anesthetic. So having the possibility to actually choose in between anesthetic, it's extremely important to vascular access.
Great. Can you walk us through your preferred technique for creating an arteriovenous fistula, for example, end to side versus side to side anastomosis, and what factors influence your decision?
I don't know about Flavia, but I personally almost never used side to side anastomosis. I always use an end to side anastomosis, and I think mostly is because that's how I learned to do it, and that's how I became comfortable in do it. And with time, you obviously and experience, you learn how to minimize the possibility of anastomotic stenosis. I think the side-to-side anastomotic has been described as the technique to try to avoid stenosis at the anastomosis, but it's technically more challenging. Sometimes we have vein and artery, they're quite apart from each other, and then doing an side-to-side anastomosis become a little bit more difficult. So I know some surgeons do a side-to-side anastomosis and then they anyway tie off the distal vein, and that to maintain the anastomotic area as large as you can. I think, as usual, it's useful to know about different techniques, and you can adapt to what you find in your field and to the vein that you have. And so it's always helpful to know the different techniques that exist.
How do you assess vessel quality intraoperatively? And what indicators would lead you to change the original plan, such as selecting a different vein or artery?
So it might be obvious to say, but first of all, you look at it. So whenever you dissect a vein, your first impression does count. You could already have a first impression if you perform your ultrasound either in theater or just pre-op, which is already very helpful. But then when you dissect the vein, you can understand the caliber. So if it looks good enough, big enough to be used, if it looks fibrotic, scarred, or with visible phlebotomy sites that sometimes we see. And so on the contrary, quite aneurysmatic and dilated and damaged by the needling sites. We, as a general rule, we always look at the vein before going into the artery, as the artery is deeper, it's a little bit more risky to dissect the artery than the vein. And whenever I'm in doubt of a vein, I always disconnect it first and assess its distensibility with heparinized saline. So I just sort of put either a bulldog or compress on the vein a little bit in the upper arm or in the forearm, and I just put heparinized saline to see how much do I gain in size. And sometimes, surprisingly, small veins dilate pretty well, and that's a good sign that makes me think that I can still perform a fistula. The second part is obviously about the artery. And again, obviously, you look at the artery, you palpate the artery, you see if there is any signs of atherosclerosis, calcifications, tortuosity, aneurysm that you didn't expect. The artery should appear smooth with no sign of thinning or injury, and obviously you should have assessed your palpable pulse even before starting a procedure. Changing fistula site is quite tricky, I find, intraoperatively, if I because it consenting process is obviously crucial, so changing is not as easy as it seems. So if I have any doubt regarding a vein or artery before, I consent my patients for, let's say, radiocephalic or brachiocephalic. And then if they're awake, I can talk to them and I can tell them my findings and go for another fistula. But if they're not consenting in advance, then changing is quite difficult and shouldn't be done.
What are the most common intraoperative complications you encounter, such as bleeding, arterial spasm, and other, and how do you address these in real time?
Fortunately, bleeding is not very common unless you don't do your anastomosis very carefully. So it shouldn't be a very common intraoperative complication. I would say probably most commonly in small veins and artery, let's say for a radiocephalic, is to have a weak palpable thrill. So a fistula that dilates but not really well, you start feeling it's pulsatile, there is not really a thrill. And there you have to assess for a few areas. One is obviously arterial spasm. Arteries do go to spasm, and whenever we apply the clamps or we clamp them with the slings, then they can sort of reduce their arterial diameter quite a bit. Sometimes simply waiting. A few surgeons are not very famous to be patients, but a few more minutes can make the difference. Sometimes we can use papaverine just applied onto the artery and see if that dilates a bit. And obviously, the other issue that you have to consider is that your vein might be kinked or twisted, and you need to make sure to have a look at the first centimeters of the vein to make sure that the angle is correct and there is no twist. I think this is the most in simple fistulas, this is the most common, intraop complication that you may have.
When working with difficult cases, such as patients with narrow or deeply located veins, what surgical adaptations do you typically use to ensure success?
This is a difficult question. I think the more you prepare for surgery, the better your outcomes are gonna be. So whenever I think I have a difficult case, I try to use ultrasound pre-op, even on the table before doing the incision, so that I know exactly like where my vein is, how deep it is, how far away from the artery is, and I try so not to be too surprised when I go in. So trying to predict difficulties, it's probably the best solution that I have in mind. And then obviously there is going to be technical challenging in difficult patients, and you try to use your problem solving skills to overcome them.
What is your protocol for immediate post-operative monitoring to assess the patency and flow of the new access?
So I think the essential part of vascular access is clinical assessment. And Flavio already talked about patient empowerment and training, which is crucial as well. A patient that knows how to assess, for instance, a thrill over the fistula is very helpful to us as well. But let's not forget about nursing training. So training of nurses and teaching the nurses, just clinical assessment of what is a bruit, was it a thrill, what do you need to expect from a fistula in the very first few days, and then after a few weeks. I think that's the key, and that's something that saves a lot of fistulas a lot of the time. If you obviously then, and after the clinical assessment, you can proceed with an ultrasound. And as Flavio was mentioning before, having a multidisciplinary team who looks at ultrasounds and requests for fistogram, for instance, later on in the life of a fistula, that is essential to have your nephrologist, your interventional radiologist, or your vascular surgeons all together to, problem solve, that specific fistula. So that's very important.
The 2023 ESVS clinical practice guidelines on antithrombotic therapy for vascular access included a few recommendations on vascular access, namely, patients undergoing formation of an anterior venous fistula should be considered for a 75 milligram of clopidogrel for up to 6 months as the first-line antiplatelet agent to improve fistula patency, and patients undergoing formation of a non-autologous arteriovenous graft may be considered for a single antiplatelet therapy for up to 6 months to improve graft patency. We actually discussed these recommendations with the antithrombotic therapy guidelines chair, Dr. Chris Twine. I encourage all our listeners to look up and listen to that podcast, the third of the Q&A series focused on these guidelines. Flavia, Roberta, have these medical therapy recommendations influenced your daily practice?
I think that these recommendations are very interesting and provide a good framework, but obviously each patient clinical situation should be considered. So should each patient should be considered individually, and factors such as comorbidities or other medications, because very often these patients are already on medication or on blood thinner, and the bleeding risk especially should be carefully evaluated before starting antiplatelet therapy. Personally, I tend to not give any anticoagulation to my patient. This is what I do. I don't know what Roberta is doing.
I do consider antiplatelet in case of grafts. I do that because, but it's a bit of a gut feeling that I have because of the higher risk of thrombosis than if feasible in specific patients. I do give antiplatelet in grafts, but not in fistula ever.
Great. Continuing on, do you have routine surveillance program for detecting stenosis in fistulas or grafts, such as with ultrasound or clinical assessment?
We personally go on clinical assessment first. So our vascular access nurses first, and then surgeons next if needed. So we don't perform routinely ultrasound surveillance on all fistulas, but we just require that in specific cases when clinical assessment shows that something may be wrong. I think that depends a lot on the center and the hospital and the capacity of your vascular lab to perform ultrasound in all patients, which for us it would definitely be a struggle. The other The other thing that we do is we routinely, for patients on dialysis through fistula, we use this transonic system, which basically monitors the flow and recirculation during dialysis of the fistula. And if there is a drop in the flow or a high circulation level, then all these patients are highlighted to us, and then we review in MDT and we decide if to proceed with an ultrasound.
We touched upon this briefly about talking about patient education. What long-term recommendations do you give to patients to protect access site, such as avoiding blood pressure measurements or venous punctures in the access arm?
Yeah, so this is very important, and it's actually very important even before creating a fistula. So the time that we decide which arm the fistula is going to be, the patients are given, at least here in the UK, a rubber bracelet which says no blood test, no blood pressure, or AVF site or something like that. So that they remember, and all the obviously the nurses who need to take bloods remember as well not to touch that arm. So not only after the fistula, but also before the fistula to try to minimize injury and damage to the veins that we're going to use for a fistula. And then, so that's a must. And then we'll tell them to be careful with the access size, to try to minimize lifting heavy bags or anything, yes, too heavy. And sometimes it's very important to discuss this before having a fistula, because depending on the job of your patients, they may, be impacted more with a forearm fistula instead of an upper arm fistula. Let's say they do a physical job where they can hit their forearm a little bit more frequently, then you can make a decision according to that as well, which fistula is better to create.
Regarding central venous stenosis in the 2018 ACCESS guidelines, PTA was considered as the primary treatment of symptomatic central venous outflow disease, with repeat interventions if indicated, and the use of stent grafts could be considered as a bailout procedure. Has this changed in the last 6 years with technological progress?
I think that PTA remains the primary treatment for symptomatic central venous stenosis, or asymptomatic as well. I think what changed is that there are drug-coated balloons that we can use. So, for instance, in our center, whenever stenosis is recurred, then we would replace it with drug-coated balloons. Okay, and then we recur to stents basically as the last resort if a stenosis has recurred, and both a simple balloon PTA or with the drug-eluting balloons has failed. This is my personal experience of what we do in our center.
Exactly. This is a good point. I think that the stent should be used if this does not preclude a future vascular access option. So is it landing in an area where in future we could do an anastomosis, for example?
And last question to both of you. Are there any other aspects of vascular access that have significantly changed and should be updated in the future guidelines?
Well, I would say definitely less invasive techniques. A lot of endovascular techniques are now in place. Technology has evolved, and the important role of the patient and the multidisciplinary team approach. I think these are really important change compared to 2018. So, and patient education, yeah.
Yes, I mean, I was thinking about obviously endovascular fistula are probably the main new thing that has come out in the latest years, and more centers are using it. So I think more evidence will come out in when and in which patients it's fine to use it, in which cases. And I think, I mean, this is not something new, but what I was thinking about this question is obviously the use of grafts in different places as well. I think the more We have complex patients with significant past history and past vascular access history. We have to get a bit creative and use grafts, for instance, like lower limb grafts, or so as surgeons, I think we are challenged to get, new places and new options for our patients, instead of, giving up, because we do see more and more complications from catheters, venous catheters in our population, I think.
Great. Thank you so much for a great discussion. It's been a pleasure talking with you today. I hope our listeners out there have found these podcasts and these updates useful. And remember, you can find all the ESVS podcast episodes in Spotify, SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, and the ESVS library. Keep tuned and talk to you soon.
Thanks. Thanks
Thanks.
again.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.